The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Science Weekly, all about one very influential British scientist.
I came here when I was 6 years old, that's almost 90 years ago. I walked up that road along there with my mother and father. They were going to the Victoria and Albert, and I'm sure it was my father who was wise and who knew that I would be bored to tears with the art exhibition that they wanted to see. He said, look, why don't you go over the road there and see those steam engines they've got there? And so I was only too delighted to enter the Science Museum, which was this wonderful cave of wonders.
Yes, James Lovelock, at the grand age of 94, is still central to the debate around our planet's climate. And this week he is honoured by the Science Museum in London with an exhibition of artefacts and memorabilia from his life's work. Everything from schoolboy drawings and a lathe he used to make early inventions to his notebooks outlining the Gaia hypothesis. Not satisfied to leave it at that, Lovelock has also just published a new book entitled A Rough Ride to the Future. It's a pragmatic and informed guide to the coming challenges for humanity on Earth. So, with such a successful life in science, where better to start our conversation than at a display case at the museum, which holds some fairly negative predictions for the young Lovelock's chances in life. James, we're stood in front of some of your school reports from the Strand School. Should be better. Chemistry are reported to be very good. His English essays are occasionally quite interesting reading.
Well, that's not bad.
And here we have talk. He does not know how to work.
True.
Did you have a good time at school?
No, I hated it. I always regarded school as a kind of prison you were sent to for being young. You had to stay. I always wanted to be a scientist from always, at least as early as the 6 years old when I first entered this place and saw what was going on. I wanted to be a scientist, and I soon discovered that you're not allowed into a laboratory until you have that piece of paper saying you've got a degree. So I thought, well, I'll just have to soldier on and put up with all this awful schooling and whatnot until I've got my degree, and then I can do science.
What do you think the young James Lovelock would say if you were able to bring him in, show him these school reports when they were still fresh in his mind, and show him this collection that you have at the Science Museum where you used to come along as a seven-year-old?
I'd be astonished, there's no question. I just would find it difficult myself to believe that life had been so fortunate and the doors had opened in the right sort of order.
Do you think it was luck?
Not entirely. I think things were very different in those days. I think it was much easier for a child with an bent towards science and invention to succeed than it is now. You see, people tend to forget, which they shouldn't because it's important in how you live, that we're no longer the great power leading the world and in charge of everything. And when they talk about we should do this, they seem to forget it's not our job anymore. That's America's job. They took over after World War II. We almost are like in a retirement home now, and we should think of ourselves a bit more that way. But back then, it was an exciting world, and if you wanted to do things, you could.
Do you think science has changed since you were a boy? It sounds like you certainly didn't like the schooling aspect, but if you've been a scientist in the system coming through these days, would you have enjoyed it?
It was infinitely easier and better then. Let me give you an example. On the first what I would call graduate job I had, I was extraordinarily lucky, and I got a post at the National Institute for Medical Research in London, and the director, believe it or not, was Sir Henry Dale. Not only was he a Nobel Prize winning scientist, a physiologist, but he's also director of that institute, about the senior science job in the country. And there was I, you know, just a wet behind the ears, a 21-year-old, being interviewed by him. And he said, my boy, he said, during the war, you won't be doing any science here. It'll all be solving problems, ad hoc problems. Many of them that we'd rather have solved yesterday than tomorrow. It's like that. But after the war, we'll get back to proper science when we'll have time to think about things and do it. So, but if you can put up with it, well, it's worth it, isn't it? It's a lovely old...
Is it worth it?
One. Of course it was worth it. But now the joke is, I found solving the ad hoc problems and all of that was what my life's been about. Far more interesting than so-called science.
What's going on here?
Oh, that was a set of Christmas cards I did for friends when I was a student in Manchester. They were done separately. That one, as you can see, is a church congregation. I think it was intended to be a Catholic church somewhere in Manchester. And the other thing has a religious flavour. I was not at that time a formal, what shall we say, I wasn't a Catholic or a Protestant or anything, but I was a Quaker. Now, Quaker religion tends to regard God as just a small, still small voice within your conscience and worries about demands put down in the Bible are not part of it. So that's very helpful for scientists to have that class of background.
Should we talk about the lathe?
Yeah.
What does this mean to you then?
What? It meant an awful lot. When in 1964, I decided that I'd spend the rest of my life as an independent scientist and set up my own lab in a cottage in a village called Bowerchalk, I knew I'd have to make my own equipment. If you're going to keep ahead in the game in science, you've got to have equipment to do accurate measurements. And it better be good equipment that you make, and that requires good instruments to build it with. And there are few things that were better than those old lathes. And as you can see, they're as well used over the time I had it.
And it's an old watchmaker's lathe. What sort of things were you making with this?
Well, like the electron capture detector that I think there's pictures of around. That's the kind of thing. It made life so much easier if you could just have an idea and then turn it out yourself on a lathe, or there's a milling equipment you could use with it. So you could do the whole thing yourself.
Is this something that comes naturally to you, being good with your hands?
Yes.
Let's have a look at the electron capture thing that you were just talking about. I think it's...
I think this is a good example because it combines all of these things.
Well, let's grab... So this is the electron capture device here, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's right. Okay, well, let's get... Sorry, should we get... James, this is the electron capture device here, correct?
Yeah, that's right. No, the question was, I had the chance... to go on a ship down to Antarctica, and that was my main motivation. I love sea journeys, and I thought, oh great, I can go down and I can measure the CFCs in the atmosphere all the way from Britain all the way to Antarctica, and that way estimate what the global atmospheric concentration of the gases are. So I need an apparatus to do it, and that took me about 3 evenings in the country doing that.
And you're machining this piece in particular is the business end, is that right?
That was rather crudely done compared with some of the things I've done, but it worked, that was the point. But not only was I doing the mechanical stuff, I also built the electronic box, which has the amplifier, power supply and all the rest, that I would use on the ship, and it got to survive 6 months' use, right down into Antarctica and back. Rough seas, God knows what else, and do the job, which it did. It worked perfectly for 6 months.
Tell us what you found with this.
Well, I found that the CFCs were adding up in the atmosphere of the world without any apparent loss. That the amount that was adding up was almost exactly the amount that industry was releasing into the atmosphere. Now, there I made one of the biggest mistakes I've made in my life. I got to know a number of very good chemists at the DuPont company, in America and asked them if they could give me data on how much CFCs had been made altogether, because they were the principal manufacturers. And they not only told me how much they had made, but also all the other companies in the world. They had a list of the whole lot. And they willingly provided, there was no money changed hands on either side from them or Musk, but the mere fact that I'd associated with DuPont to mention them in my first paper, I was a bought man of industry by the Greens, and I'm afraid the left took the same line. There was a kind of blindness about things that were terrible, really. But how else could I find out?
What did it take for that to get accepted?
Oh, quite a long time. Well, you know, there's a Montreal Protocol that had been banned.
Mm. What have we got here?
That's an old-fashioned gas meter, but when you're doing things like finding out the amount of CFCs in the atmosphere of the world, you've got, first of all, to do all sorts of tedious things. Like, you've got to know exactly how much gas is flowing along through a gas chromatograph column like that. And some of the old-fashioned gear that you could get quite cheaply in those days gave you very accurate answers. It had to be accurate, because the gas company wanted to know exactly how much to the last farthing of gas people were using. So I used one of them to do it. And in the same way, you had to know the atmospheric pressure with old-fashioned barometers and things like that. You have to be professional to be thorough if you're going to do science. You can't be sloppy about it.
Is it harder to invent these days with everything? Is there a shift away from mechanical machinery like this to a more silicon-based machinery and technology that's needed?
In some ways, it's easier. It depends on what the way your mind works and how you're looking at. But you can invent software. I mean, you can devise all manners of things in the mind, so to speak, and software. You don't even have to make it.
Lovelock's faith in computing is apt, as his theory of interlocked climatic systems is now explored with supercomputers in the hope of predicting how Earth's atmosphere will change. In his new book, Lovelock puts forward some big ideas about humans and our role in the evolution of our planet. But I was curious, what were the key ideas that he wanted people to grasp?
Oh, well, perhaps the most important one that will please them most is that we are a truly important species on the Earth. Perhaps as important as the photosynthesizers that have commonly as the plants, the trees, the vegetables and so on.
Why are we so important?
Well, those photosynthesizers were the first organisms to be able to take the energy of sunlight and turn it into food and mechanical energy, everything else on the Earth that's made life interesting and possible. Where we're unusually special, and only very recently, is we're the first animals ever on the planet to take sunlight and convert its content of information into something we could use and build on.
Why do you think that makes us important for the future of other life on Earth, though?
Without information, you can't get anywhere. I mean, we've got where we are by blind chance. Darwinian natural selection is a chancy process. And it's taken us, goddammit, nearly 3 billion years to get here. That's awful slow. And the Earth doesn't have that much longer left to develop further things.
You talk in the book about how it's crucial for us to survive, almost for other life on Earth to survive as well. And you mentioned that cities might have a role in this. Where do cities come in?
Well, I think in the evolution of the nearest model to us in the animal world, the nearest model is the ants and termites, little insects like that. They learnt very early on that the most efficient way of living is to live in a city, which they call a nest. And you get special cases of it with a termite's nest in Australia and tropical countries, where there can even be great air conditioning towers built up specially for the benefit of the inhabitants of the city. And that's existed for nearly 100 million years, so it must be good.
Where does that play a role for our future then? I mean, we already live in cities. Urbanisation is carrying on apace.
Exactly. Well, let's take advantage of it. You see, instead of talking about saving the planet, air conditioning the planet, changing the temperature of the planet, it's bad enough that we're doing it accidentally. To do it deliberately, I think, is absolutely criminal. Don't do that. Do what the termites do. Say, well, that's happening. How do we live without that? And to air condition a city to the temperature you want is quite easy compared with the planet.
Do you think we should give up trying to save the planet then?
Exactly. We should not only we've got to give it up. And we've got to really make it clear to those very silly people who think we can save the planet to cease and desist.
So we hunker down in cities. It's quite a sort of dystopian view, isn't it?
Not necessarily. Most people, as you said, are doing it anyway.
What do you think we should do about the growing human population? Do you think they can be taken in by the sort of megacities you're talking about?
I don't know. Fred Pearce, I think, the writer, had a very good idea on this. He raised the point that once you have a society where women are given fair and equal places, then they won't go on producing vast numbers of children unnecessarily. And so population will stabilise automatically.
You talk also about in the future of the merging of humans and electronics. Why do you see that happening, and what do you see the consequences of that?
Well, it is happening. I've got a pacemaker in me, and that's a bit of electronic gear that just sits in, operates according to my physiology, and sends signals to my heart to make sure it beats at the right time for whatever the occasion is. That's only a very primitive start. I can see it won't be long before that thing, which at the moment has a 10-year battery, isn't powered by my bodily system and is much more automatic. And people have already got implants in their brains that will enable them to hear, who are otherwise deaf, implants that will enable them to see a bit when they were blind. Now, it's important to recognise that the brain is so flexible that it can take in digital signals along wires leading to implants like that and translate them into sight or sound, as the case may be. It's much more flexible than we'd ever dreamt. Now, this raises the possibility of all sorts of combinations between electronic life forms, which are very fast, potentially, a million times faster than us, and ourselves. And if that isn't a future, I don't know what is.
But do you think for this to become an issue of evolution, of human evolution, this has to be woven into us so that we would pass on to next generations?
Absolutely. And at this stage of the game, I can't envisage anything of that kind that would breed true. But it's very early days. It's the very first steps. Think how long it took the first living cells to turn into something like us. And you realise we're not talking about a few weeks, even a few thousand years. We're talking about millennia and longer.
You've got an enormous pedigree of inventing. Which inventions are most dear to you, or do you feel were most important in your life?
Almost impossible to say. I wouldn't classify them any more than I classify people according to their value or importance in life. They represent challenges, excitements, adventures. You never invent anything unless somebody comes along and says, we need this, need something. It's a great curse of inventors, is they don't automatically generate needs. Somebody's got along and say, we need this.
Do you enjoy the process of inventing?
Oh, immensely, yes.
What does it give you?
A kick, in simple terms.
One of your inventions, and through your work, is you're partially credited with really the start of the environmental movement.
Yeah.
How do you think it's gone? How's it worked out?
Very badly, I think. You see, the idea of a green or somebody like that in the old days was somebody like Gilbert White, the naturalist, somebody who was very fond of going for walks in the country or around the coast of Britain, which is very beautiful, of enjoying nature as it was. It's developed into rather frantic groups of people who sit around like in political movements and rant on about big business destroying the world with poisonous products. I mean, it's turned from a rather pleasant, gentle sort of delight in the world into a ranting political movement.
Do you think your independence has helped you to keep the path that you've taken?
Probably.
You're best known probably for Gaia theory. How's that changed in your mind over the past decades?
Very little. It stayed the same thing that it was when it came into my mind in the Jet Propulsion Laboratories of NASA, only 3 years after NASA had been founded, a long, long time ago.
In the book, you talk about trusting Gaia, and you refer to the wisdom of Gaia and making Gaia into some sort of intelligent entity.
Well, don't push me too far and things like that. I'm a romantic. I can't help it. I'm much more of a poet by nature than anything else. And I tend to use words like that because I like using words, just like you do. It's part of your job.
You're here with a collection of your life's work in the Science Museum. What does that mean to you?
Oh, it means an immense amount. You've no idea how much, as I'll be telling them shortly. I came here when I was 6 years old. That's almost 90 years ago. I walked up that road along there with my mother and father. They were going to the Victoria and Albert, and I'm sure it was my father who was wise and who knew that I would be bored to tears with the art exhibition that they wanted to see. Said, look, why don't you go over the road there and see those steam engines they've got there? And of course, people forget all that time ago, steam engines were as exciting to young boys, as airplanes and all sorts of spacecraft and things are today. And so I was only too delighted to enter the Science Museum, which was this wonderful cave of wonders.
Are you at the point where you want to give over the inventing and the science to others, or are you working on something now?
No. My father was inventing when he was 2 weeks from dying, so I only hope to follow his example.
Many thanks to the extraordinary James Lovelock. The exhibition celebrating his life and work is open to the public now at the Science Museum in London. And to watch a short video of my interview with James Lovelock at the Science Museum, just go to theguardian.com/science. That's all we have for you this week. From me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.